Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I want to put you in a scenario a bit seasonal.
Oh, yeah? A seasonal Halloween scenario?
Okay. Do you want to go with me on a hike?
Yeah, let's go on a hike.
All right. It's late October, and you are on a solitary fall hike through the woods, and the leaves are starting to turn orange and red. The air is dry, and you feel like an adventure, so you head off trail.
Okay.
Not always a good idea, but let's just say you're brave.
This is how all terrible stories start, how all tragedies begin. You leave the trail.
Well, it starts very nice. So you're off trail and you find a little mountain brook and it's twisting among the rocks and you decide, oh, how sweet. I'm going to follow this upstream. Maybe I'll find its source. And on the way, you come across a cluster of what look like oak trees, thick trunks with roots spread out exposed over the bank of the brook. And there's an odd smell. It's a little bit sweet with just a hint of deep earthiness, kind of like overripe fruit.
Okay.
So you approach the stand of trees, and the ground is covered with a mat of these beautifully colored fallen leaves. And as you come near the trunk of the nearest tree, your foot knocks against a smooth stone tangled in the outer roots. But wait a second. That's no stone.
Uh-oh.
It's smooth and white, partially buried with two eye-shaped hollows. And then suddenly, with a rushing sound and a scattering of leaves up into the air, something envelops you. The light gets blotted out. You feel these wooden fibers pressing into your skin from all sides. What's going on? You struggle to free yourself, but you find that you're becoming sluggish, disoriented. There's a powerful smell. Your throat burns. And then the digestive enzymes come.
Ah.
Another visitor disappears into the grove of the killer tree.
Ah, I knew it was a killer tree. Once the digestive enzymes in the wood started happening. Because my first instinct would be, oh, something was in the tree. I got myself tangled, and then something was in the tree, and it jumped down upon me, some sort of predator of some sort.
I guess that's the more logical thing to think, right?
Yeah, at least until the wood comes.
Or that somebody has set some kind of trap for you.
Yes.
This is of human design. That's probably what I would guess. But Robert, well, what first comes to your mind when I say killer tree? I'm sure you've got like a fictional anchor point that you go to.
Oh, I mean, there are so many there's so many examples of killer trees, and especially in fantasy, right? I mean, it makes you think of the Ents, or especially like the dark sort of tree people from Dungeons and Dragons.
I'm not really familiar with those. What happens when you fight a tree person?
Well, you know, they're big, they're wooden, they're they're lumbering. I think there are a few different varieties. They're basically, you know, they're animate trees, and then they're sort of wooden people, and they're good ones, and they're bad ones. Of course, the Ents we encounter in Lord of the Rings are good.
So when you're battling a tree person, do you have to have a paladin with a blessed wood chipper or something?
I don't recall there being a requirement for magical weapons. Of course, you know, some creatures can only be fought with natural weapons, but with magical weapons. But I believe that the tree creatures in this case are just big, tough trees.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. They're large. Their flesh is different than us. So the idea of them becoming animate, the idea of them turning against us, is terrifying. And they do turn against us. I mean, we live in a very tree friendly city. So anytime the wind blows, anytime the rain freezes, the trees rattle and threaten us.
Oh,
and when they fall, they can cause significant damage and even loss of life.
There is a killer tree hanging over our house right now.
Yeah.
Rachel and I are working on getting something done about that. But yeah, it's this old dead pecan tree. It just looks like it is aching to plunge its killer branches through somebody's roof. And so, yeah, there are, of course, killer trees in reality, but the kind we're thinking of are the ones that are a little more conscious, with some directed action, agency, maybe some arms, some tentacles, some gaping maws with thorn teeth.
Oh, of course, one of the big ones, and this one entered my mind when you were taking me through this description, was, of course, in Poltergeist. There's that just horrifying scene that scarred me from an early age, where you have multiple things going on at once. Like, there's the creepy clown doll on the bed, but then there's the tree outside the window that's like trying to eat the child.
Man, so I haven't seen Poltergeist in years. I honestly don't remember this scene. I guess I've got to go back to it.
It was one of many, you know, they throw a lot of nightmare imagery up against the wall, and a fair amount of it sticks.
So I got to tell you that this episode, I wanted to do this topic because I was inspired by having recently watched the William Friedkin horror movie The Guardian from 1990 for the first time.
I remember the trailer for this. It's like a creepy babysitter, a creepy nanny, but I never saw it, so I don't know what the gimmick is.
Well, I'll give you the premise. It's about a couple who has a baby, and they're looking for a nanny because they both want to go right back to work immediately. So they're looking for a nanny to take care of their child, and they end up going with Camilla, the British nanny, who unfortunately is a druid who's got a tree friend, and her tree friend is a killer tree friend, and she likes to take babies to the tree, sacrifice them to the tree, except it's this weird thing where the tree sort of absorbs the baby, and then you can see the baby's face embedded in the surface of the tree. So I guess that the baby kind of melts into the tree and becomes petrified.
Huh.
Anyway, she's an evil druid, kidnaps babies, sacrifices them to a killer tree. There are scenes where the tree kills people. There's like, Camilla gets attacked in the woods by some creeps who just happen to be hanging out in the woods, and the tree defends her by essentially smashing them and tearing them up.
So would you say this is part of the druid exploitation movement of the 1990s?
Man, if only there were such a genre, I would be all over that. I would be like a film scholar of that genre. But anyway, so do I recommend this movie? It's not a good movie, but it's William Friedkin, so it's like a well-made bad movie, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, there's a certain segment of his filmography that definitely fits that category. Always worth checking out if you're a fan of his, but, you know, maybe not top shelf.
I guess I'd say it's not good, but it's worth seeing, especially since, spoiler alert, the climax of the film involves a chainsaw.
Oh, well, of course it would. Of course, there are plenty of other cinematic examples of animate trees, murdering trees, and just murderous plants. Aside from Ents, there's I don't know if anyone remembers the sexy matron tree from The Last Unicorn.
No.
Where the tree becomes animate and attempts to love our hero to death, or one of our two heroes, the male hero Smedric, I believe. And
sounds troubling.
Oh yeah, she has like huge bosoms and all.
Weird.
It's a weird film when you look back on it. Lots of strange elements. Scott Smith's novel, The Ruins, and the 2008 movie adaptation of it concerns man-eating vines.
Yeah, and they're sort of infectious, right? So it's not just that the vines reach out and grab you, but that there's a spore element where they contaminate you with some kind of plant germ cell.
Yeah. Which is interesting when you start getting into some of the technical possibilities of man-eating plants.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I already mentioned poltergeists. There are, of course, the vines in Evil Dead that are rather notorious.
Yeah.
There is some man-eating plant action in 1987's A Chinese Ghost Story, which I have not seen yet.
I haven't seen that either.
After reading a synopsis of part of it yesterday, it's moved back up to the top of my must-watch list. You got the Whomping Willow in Harry Potter. You have a version of the Evil Dead vines that are mentioned in Cabin in the Woods, the quote angry molesting tree,
ugh,
which I think you only see like a fragment of it as it like snatches a guard in one scene.
Man, Cabin in the Woods is full of just great little freeze frame moments.
Oh yeah, tremendous. There are various kaiju that giant monsters that have had plant elements to them, and certainly plenty with fungi elements to them. And I believe one of Michael Shea's NIFT stories features a carnivorous plant, kind of like a Venus flytrap, except it has a humanoid female part in the middle to lure males inside it.
Weird.
But I don't have a clear memory of that, so maybe I'm imagining it, but it seems like the kind of thing that would be in one of his stories.
Now, almost all of these seem like modern fictional inventions. Now, are there animated trees, animated predatory trees or plants going back in mythology? I would expect to find such a thing.
But I expected to find some better examples, and I was not able to find any. Not to say that I didn't miss something, but the closest example that I came across, and I got excited about this, is this example of something called a jidra. And this is from the traditions and folk beliefs of the Middle East. But here's the caveat, as related by medieval European travelers. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme we're going to see time and time again.
Yep.
The plants become animate and man-killing only in foreign environments entered by Westerners.
Right. European and American travel writers and mm-hmm. catalogers of things going on in places other than Europe and America in the Americas talk about man-eating plants.
Right. And in this case, as related by medieval European travelers, and this was explained by Carol Rose in her always excellent Giants, Monsters, and Dragons encyclopedia, the idea is this thing emerges from the ground like a plant. And
the jidra, you mean?
The jidra.
Yeah.
And it's rooted in place, and it just consumes anything in its vicinity, cattle, small animals, and of course humans. The only way to kill it is to detach it from its root, essentially chop it down, and if you do, then you get to harvest its bones, because I guess it has bones, which would be valuable.
It has bones?
Apparently. That's according to the myth. So I don't know if this means that it literally has bones, that it's a rooted mammal, vertebrate creature of some sort, or if bones, and by bones we mean it's like it's wood, you know?
You know, that does sound valuable, because you could probably use the bones of the jidra to make a totally vegan stock, right?
Oh.
So you roast the bones and then make a chicken stock or something. But
yeah,
this would be vegan, I suppose.
Yeah, depending on exactly how you classify a monster like this. Now, I should also add that it's thought that this myth probably also derived from the mandrake.
Okay.
So, you know, European influence, idea of the mandrake, which is this kind of like animal, vegetable hybrid creature, and then this kind of evolves into this tale of the jidra.
Okay.
And I find it curious, though. You know, I looked around for more examples, couldn't find it. I would have expected Pliny the Elder, the noted first century Roman historian, who often spoke of foreign monstrosities, to have like a clear-cut example of a man-eating plant in a foreign land.
Oh, yeah. Pliny the Elder is like the internet, right? Like, if you can think it up, it's on there.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine it, Pliny wrote about it.
Yeah, like beast people in other lands, the people with the bellies that had mouths in them. I mean, all sorts of strange humanoid monstrosities, beastly monstrosities, dragons, etc. So why no man-eating plants? I don't know.
Now, Robert, did you ever see M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening?
I did not. I saw the trailer.
It happened. There was some happening, and it happened. And it was about trees that were trying to kill Mark Wahlberg. I have no idea why they'd want to do that. But it wasn't really predatory behavior. It was more like vindictive jerk behavior. So the trees didn't want to eat us. They were, like, tired of us being abusive to them.
So it was even less biologically sound.
Yes.
Than any of the examples we've looked at thus far.
So yeah, obviously this idea of the killer tree, the man-eating plant, is one that captures our imagination very easily. And I think I've got a theory as to why, and let me know what you think of this. I think the reason we like the image of the killer tree and it shows up in all these stories is because the idea of a man-eating plant has a certain level of why not to it. Right.
So yeah.
There are creatures in nature that kill large animals with claws and teeth and tentacles and venom and such. And plants have things that are equivalent to this. They've got thorns, vine tendrils, poisons. Trees are much larger than us. And in one sense, they are apt to be much, quote, stronger than any animal prey that would try to resist them. So why not? You know, if the continent of Australia can produce an animal that has the fur of a mammal and the bill of a duck, why couldn't some deep, unexplored forest harbor a tree that can reach out with a vine covered in venomous thorns and snatch a hiker, wrap him up real tight until he turns blue, and then pull him down into a crevice in the root structure and treat him like a soft, salty meal?
Yeah, I agree. I think on one hand, certainly we look at all the variety in nature. We see what's possible within nature. And you ask yourself, well, why doesn't this exist? Maybe it does exist. Maybe some, you know, a third or fourth hand tale that I've heard about a man-eating plant is from a traveler is actually true. And on the other hand, I think the reason it's so appealing is because it's abhorrent.
Yeah.
The idea
it's that, crossing categories.
Exactly.
That inherent taboo.
Yeah, because I find myself kind of like if I see an example of an insect preying on a vertebrate, like invertebrates eating vertebrates.
Yes,
it's something that kind of like,
it's
it feels wrong.
When but a course, spider's got a frog in its web.
Yeah, it's like that. You're not supposed to move in that direction. Stick to your own invertebrate kind. But of course, it happens.
Now, of course, I wouldn't actually blame the spider for that.
No.
I think that's perfectly fine.
But. No judgments, spiders. But it, from our human standpoint, it's even more abhorrent because we've largely removed ourselves from the risk of predation, like, which is a pretty remarkable thing in the grand scheme of things, right? And so we don't have to worry about other animals eating us. And the idea of another animal eating us is strange and awful and terrifying, even more so the idea that a tree could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It totally seems, it goes backwards on the chain, the food chain, right? It's reversing the food chain. It's not supposed to be this way. So except for the fact that we've never seen things like this happen at an intuitive level, it's like, what's so implausible about it? Then at the same time, I think we may be able to come up with some good biological reasons we don't actually see organisms like this. But according to some, we must say, not very credible accounts, there is nothing all that implausible about the man-eating tree, the killer tree, because people have written about these things as if they actually exist within the past few hundred years.
Yeah, and that hearsay was more powerful in previous times. Yeah,
exactly. So I want to talk about one source, a very weird biology book from the 1880s called Sea and Land, written by a guy named James William Buell. Now, just glancing through this thing and looking at the author's introduction, it is obvious that this is not a source of credible scientific information. It's more one of those 19th century natural wonders books. You ever seen these kind of things? Where they're, you know, like, wow, look at all these illustrations of animals in their natural habitats, but they're all grossly inaccurate. And it's
really not all that different from various versions of Pliny's work from previous times.
Exactly, except it's, you know, 1800 years later, whenever Pliny was living. Yeah, exactly. So, but it's got all these allegations of weird, sensational creatures mingled in with reports about real animals. And I have to also say, it's like a very Eurocentric sense of exoticism about the planet. So there's that kind of unsavory element to it. But it's also full of gruesome and probably highly inaccurate illustrations about various animals in attack mode. And some of these illustrations are great. There's a good one of an orangutan apparently kicking a man to death. One of a swordfish stabbing at a sailor through the hull of a boat.
Not impossible. Extremely rare. But as we've discussed in our jumping fish episode, it has happened.
Okay. Well,
individuals have been stabbed. Boats have been stabbed. I don't know of any, I don't remember a case of both happening.
That'd be really bad luck.
Yeah.
But yeah, in this case, it looks like the swordfish is trying to kill the guy.
Oh, okay.
But in any case, there's another one that's awesome. It's a giant crab hanging from a tree, lifting a goat up into the tree with its claw, man, as if to devour it. But then finally, a tree with tentacles pulling a human victim into the crown of its trunk.
I have to say, these different accounts here, I couldn't help but think of a Simpson episode, and I don't even remember the context, but there being a scene where a gorilla is in a tree, and a shark comes out of the river underneath it and eats the gorilla as an example of, like, natural predation or something.
Oh, wow. So Buell says that travelers have told him stories of a carnivorous plant that grows in Central Africa and South America, and he says it's so voracious it even resorts to eating humans. And I want to read a quote from the book. He says, quote, "This marvelous vegetable minotaur is represented as having a short, thick trunk from the top of which radiate giant spines, narrow and flexible, but of extraordinary tenaciousness, the edges of which are armed with barbs or dagger-like teeth. Instead of growing upright or at an inclined angle from the trunk, these spines lay their outer ends upon the ground, and so gracefully are they distributed that the trunk resembles an easy couch with green drapery around it." Then he goes on to say that the unfortunate traveler will come along and, quote, "The moment his feet are set within the circle of horrid spines, they rise up like gigantic serpents and entwine themselves about him until he is drawn upon the stump, when they speedily drive their daggers into his body and thus complete the massacre. The body is crushed until every drop of blood is squeezed out of it and becomes absorbed again by the gore-loving plant, when the dry carcass is thrown out and the horrid trap is set again."
Some elements of that sound reasonable, especially later when we get into real world carnivorous plants and the idea that plants are living things that live and move at an entirely different speed. And therefore, when you see like fast moving action, such as from a Venus flytrap, it is very much like a crossbow, a heavy crossbow that has been painstakingly loaded over time and then sprung.
Yeah.
So I could see this idea of like a sprung trap conceivably working within the confines of actual botany.
Yeah, yeah, with a certain type of movement, you can imagine it. Less so when, especially with something we're going to hear about in a second, though I'd also want to add a funny note that, in contrast to the passage I just read, that in the introduction, Buell says his purpose in writing the book is to, quote, "bring us into a closer relation with and a better understanding and appreciation of the mysterious and infinite wisdom of nature's God." I mean, that certainly sounds like a devil-created tree, if there ever is such a thing. But anyway, so Buell says that a gentleman of his acquaintance who lived sometime in Central America affirms the existence of a plant like this there, except with a few variations. So he says that instead of lying on the ground, the filaments of the plant, quote, "move themselves constantly in the air like so many huge serpents in an angry discussion, occasionally darting from side to side as if striking at an imaginary foe." Now, that sounds like not a plant.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing I can think to that is, say, like a pussy willow with the wind blowing through it, you know?
Right. But anyway, he goes on to describe how this tree would crush its prey in an embrace of spines, and he compares it to the method of execution from alleged medieval torture dungeons known as the Iron Maiden. He also claims that in some regions, the locals are said to punish criminals by casting them into the tree, witches too. Anybody practicing witchcraft, you go straight into the tree, and that the plant is known as Yate Veo, Spanish for "I see you," though I double-checked the translation, and apparently it has a tensed inflection, really meaning "I already see you," which is even a little creepier.
I do like that an almost certainly non-existent man-eating plant, the comparison is made to the almost certainly non-existent, at least functional terms, Iron Maiden.
Yeah, yeah. That is the case, right? Like, I've heard there's no good evidence that Iron Maidens were actually used.
Correct.
Is that right?
That is my understanding, that they became kind of they were an invention, and then took on a new life as kind of a fetish item for those that wish to possess torturous objects.
Weird. Anyway, I hate to be a downer, but I think we can be pretty certain that this is all a bunch of nonsense. Like this just sounds like complete fabrication. There may be, maybe massive, massive exaggerations of something people actually saw that was in reality nothing like what's being described.
Yeah.
There are no trees with killer squid tentacles that we know of, and I think we can just say there are no such trees because it doesn't make any biological sense to have trees with writhing tentacles that move around constantly.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of to this would be the fact that, yes, vines grow on the ground and you could trip over a vine, your leg could become entangled, and you could hit your head on a rock or
right,
something.
Right, yeah, sort of passive entrapment.
Yeah.
That makes more sense.
But hardly a scenario that I could see plants evolving to utilize as part of their primary survival tactic.
Right. But we will talk about the biological possibilities of such a megafauna eating plant later on in this episode. But we should say that the Yate Veo and Buell's accounts here are not the only supposedly true accounts, or at least presented as true by the recounters of these man-eating plants or these giant killer trees.
Yeah. And these next two examples, like our previous two examples, are exotic trees in a foreign land as experienced or at least related by Westerners.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the Madagascar tree, and this was something of a sensation at the time, appearing in publications of the 1870s. The idea here was that you had Western missionaries led by a German explorer called Carl Leachy, and they encountered a tribe of cave-dwelling tribespeople in Madagascar who made sacrifices to a man-eating plant. There's a fun quote from this where they talk about the atrocious cannibal tree that had been so inert and dead came to sudden savage life. The slender, delicate palpi with the fury of starved serpents quivered a moment over her head, then, as if instinct with demonic intelligence, fastened upon her in sudden coils round and round her neck and arms. Then, while her awful screams and yet more awful laughter rose wildly to be instantly strangled down again into a gurgling moan, the tendrils, one after another, like great green serpents with brutal energy and infernal rapidity, rose, retracted themselves, and wrapped her about in fold after fold, ever tightening with cruel swiftness and savage tenacity of anacondas fastening upon their prey.
A little applause for your reading there, Robert.
Well, and more so to whoever wrote it, because that's one tremendous run-on sentence. I love it.
It's true. You can't stop for a breath. That is obviously some sensational detail. That does not sound like an account intending on clinical accuracy.
Yeah, I do not buy it for a second. So some people have. The plant has achieved something of cryptid status. Mm-hmm. Even the 27th governor of Michigan, Chase Osborne, claimed that it was legit.
Really?
But no evidence has ever been presented, and it seems to have been a little more than a literary fabrication.
Yeah, that just seems like another one of those kind of like Eurocentric stories of the exotic weirdness of other lands.
Yeah, I mean, another example, and I'm not going to go into the details on this one, but Phil Robinson in 1881, writing in Under the Punkah, described tales of man-eating trees in southern Egypt. And this one is called the Nubian Tree.
Hmm.
All these accounts, they have this sort of ickiness to it of, oh, well, a Westerner being eaten. Westerners live in a special land where trees know their place, and we're above even predation by other vertebrates.
But it's like everybody wants these things to exist. Like, you can't stand the idea that they're not real. You just don't want them to be near you. They're hidden in some other place where you don't live.
A savage land full of savage people.
According to these recounters, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to say that that's like the only element at play here. I mean, also just like the idea of man-eating plants is really cool.
I don't want to suggest that the desire to encounter a man-eating tree is necessarily linked to some kind of colonial xenophobia.
Right. But I feel like there are some elements there that are a little icky to modern readers. All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, We will ask the question, indeed a question that Glenn Danzig may have asked, why do plants kill?
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
All right, we're back. Tell me, Joe, why do the plants kill?
Well, that is a good question, because in the realm of the well-known, of course, there are plants that kill.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So we've been talking about trees that prey on humans in these legendary accounts that are pretty obviously false. But there are plants that kill, not just with defensive toxins and thorns, but with predatory tactics. They've got specially designed morphological features to trap, poison, paralyze, dissolve, and digest prey animals, generally insects. These are the predatory flora, if you will, the eaters. So let's discuss a few scientific facts about the eaters. First, I think we should ask the question, why would a plant kill to eat? I mean, think about it for a second. A defining feature of what makes a plant, the plant kingdom, is the fact that plants, unlike us, are autotrophs. They make their own food. So the energy that they need to survive, they get from photosynthesis. There's energy in the sunlight coming down from the sky, and they use that energy from pure sunlight to create a chemical reaction where they react carbon dioxide from the air and water, in the end, producing chemical energy in the form of glucose, sugars.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the energy economy of life on Earth, generally speaking, plants are the only ones with an ethical get-out-of-jail-free card, right?
Like, microorganisms that are autotrophs,
But everything else is having to consume something else for its energy, has to steal its energy. But here we have all these plants getting their energy from the sun.
Well,
seems cut and dry.
I wouldn't let them off the hook too much for the ethical quandaries, because plants and, well, not necessarily plants, but autotrophs did some atmospheric engineering that led to great extinction events and killed probably more organisms than any meat eater ever has.
This is true. Yes.
But anyway, so plants get most of their energy from this harmless process. Why would they ever need to trap an insect and digest it? That just seems like it's redundant. It doesn't make any sense. And to find the answer, we can look at where these carnivorous plants usually live. So most often, you're going to find them in inhospitable growing conditions, the nutrient-poor soil of bogs, fens, and swamps, places where there might be plenty of access to sunlight, hopefully water too, but in the words of the old man from Pet Cemetery, the ground is sour.
Ah.
There is not enough nutrition in the ground. So what does nutrition mean for a plant? This is the first fact, by the way. Carnivorous plants eat for nutrients, not for energy. They don't need the chemical energy within you. They need your compounds or your molecules. So just like human beings, plants rely on the environment for essential nutrients, right? So if you're stuck in an environment where you get plenty of food energy through sugar, but you have no dietary access to some essential nutrient like vitamin C, your health will deteriorate. You've probably read about this on old like ships, you know, the sailors out on the man of war or whatever.
Scurvy.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So without vitamin C, you're going to start to experience some not so great symptoms. You're going to have dry, splitting hair, rough, scaly skin, inflamed gums and gum bleeding, nosebleeds, wounds and bruises that won't heal. This is all because your body can't synthesize vitamin C on its own. You have to get it from your diet. And eventually, if your diet is really deficient in vitamin C, you're going to develop scurvy, in which you experience extreme fatigue, loss of strength in the connective tissues all over your body. Like, your body needs vitamin C in order to make collagen for these connecting tissues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also going to have fragility in the walls of your blood vessels, which is as not good as it sounds. Likewise, plants need essential nutrients too, right? They can't make everything they need to survive within their bodies. They have to get it from their environment. And one example of this is nitrogen.
Mm.
So most plants get nitrogen through their roots from the soil around them. They reach out into the ground with all of their roots and they pull up these molecules. They pull up these nitrogen atoms from the ground. And if the soil is nitrogen poor, or it gets robbed of nitrogen somehow, like apparently this can happen if there's over introduction of carbon into the soil, plants in the area can suffer nitrogen deficiency, which is kind of a scurvy for plants. You see with this stunted growth, leaves turning yellow and pale and body structures that look kind of wilted or sick. So if you are the plant equivalent of a vitamin C starved sailor with bleeding gums and fragile joints living in this nutrient poor soil, where do you get your essential nutrients? Well, you could snatch up and digest something that has plenty of nutritious molecules in it, like an insect.
You know, and we discussed in a previous episode, the weird mushroom episode, that you see this exact scenario play out with oyster mushrooms.
Oh, yeah?
In which there's a nitrogen deficiency, and therefore they have adapted to prey on nematodes and in some cases spiders.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And then of course we turn around and eat the oyster mushrooms.
Well, they are delicious.
Who's tasting who?
You never eat a spider on purpose, but who knows how many times you get one down the chain.
That's the old myth, right? The average person eats 60 spiders a night.
I think
they just crawl right in there.
That's a myth, right? That's not true.
That's an exaggeration of a myth on my part. All right, so what else do we have?
Okay, so here's another fact about carnivorous plants. So this trick, this insect-eating trick, in order to get nitrogen and other nutrients that the plant needs, it's a good trick. And for that reason, the carnivorous phenotype evolved multiple times independently. So there was no one carnivorous ancestor plant that all carnivorous plants today can be traced back to. This is an example, or scientists think this is an example, of what's known as convergent evolution. So it would be kind of like flight. There's no one flying animal that all flying animals today evolved from. Flight is a solution that was reached by evolution in different branches of the tree of life independently and at different times.
Right. At least three different times.
Yeah. Carnivory in plants is the same way. It's a survival strategy that's so good, different branches on the tree of life adopt it separately in separate evolutionary contexts. Let's go to a third fact related to the previous one. Carnivorous plants come in a lot of different varieties. You're probably familiar with Venus flytraps.
Yeah, they're the superstars.
Yeah, but they're not the only ones. There are multiple different types of carnivorous plants. It actually occurs in, according to one source I found, at least 9 families, 19 genera, and 600 species of plant. And so it could be more by now.
Yeah, I think just a few years ago, I saw a source saying 500. So we apparently just continually are discovering new examples of this.
Yeah. So what are the different types of carnivorous plants?
Well, you have a few different models, a few different methods out there. First of all, snap trap plants, Venus flytraps, water wheel plants. This is the iconic example of the little trap that slowly opens and then a fly lights in the middle and the gates close over it.
So it's kind of a trigger plate kind of.
Yeah, exactly. It has a trigger plate. It works very much like a wolf trap or a fox trap or a bear trap, right? And these are, you know, these are famous because they're beautiful. They're relatively easy to cultivate, or at least buy at a store and keep alive for a certain period of time in your home.
Right. I had one when I was a kid one time.
Yeah.
In, I think, consolation for the fact that my mom took me to a very long, boring time at a plant nursery where she was buying some flowers or something. I asked in return to get this Venus flytrap and I got it. And it was very cool, but I recall I got it home and I couldn't get it to close on anything.
Oh yeah. I never had one as a kid, though certainly it would be the only plant I would have been interested in as a child. I had one for a while, maybe 10 years ago. My wife and I had one called Monster Tom and we kept hoping it would catch flies. Like it would be one of those things where you would let a fly live in the house because you're like, all right, let Monster Tom take care of it. And I don't think Monster Tom ever ate a single fly, but it was still a beautiful little plant to have around.
I wonder if the domesticated Venus flytraps have gotten soft. You know,
maybe.
They just don't prey on flies like
they just
they
know
used
they've
to.
Got to have like big, beautiful eyelashes, right? I mean, cause.
Right. But of course, these are known as the snap trap plants, and they're not the only kind. This also includes water wheel plants, right? Mm-hmm. Did we say that?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. But there are plenty of other kinds too. Like, how about pitfall traps?
Oh yeah. The main example of this being, pitcher plants.
Yeah.
Which is one I believe they have them in Newfoundland, Canada, and that's where I kind of encountered them early on when
really?
I was a kid. Yeah. Or at least some variety of them because they're pretty widespread. And these are lovely specimens. The leaves fold into deep, slippery pools filled with digestive enzymes. So it's essentially a champagne flute that's filled with insect death.
Yeah, but it's got this slippery slide going down into it.
Yeah, so the insect light slides down, is caught in the goo, and dissolves. So it's kind of monstrous, but also they're beautiful plants. So you see them a lot of by botanical gardens.
Yeah.
I'm always seeing them.
Often with some kind of chemical attractant to bring the insects in.
Right. That's
to lure them down. And then there's something I read about the special surfaces, right? Like the surfaces on the lip of the pitcher plant become slippery when wet. So it's hard to scramble back up them. Mm-hmm. You just kind of slide ineluctably down into the pit.
Yeah. And of course it's worth reminding everyone that like one of the key things here is that plants and insects have a long history with insects serving as pollinators for so many different plant varieties.
Oh yeah, there's actually a study about that I want to mention in a few minutes here. But anyway, the pitcher plants.
Yeah, there are numerous varieties of this, and the earliest fossil evidence of a carnivorous plant might be a pitcher plant. The mid-early Cretaceous Archaeomorpha longicervia was discovered in what's now northeastern China. And researchers are now split on the matter, with newer research arguing that it might not be a pitcher plant at all. Some of the others, especially the earlier papers, saying that, oh, this definitely is a pitcher plant, or at least sort of a proto-pitcher plant. And so it's kind of a problematic fossil
Okay.
Right now. But there's a possibility. Other than that, there's not a whole lot of fossil evidence of carnivorous plants. So any dreams you might have out there, listeners, for a prehistoric mammal.
Like a giant one.
Yeah, like a giant one that's eating dinosaurs or prehistoric mammals. Well, it's not in the fossil record at any rate.
Man, that's a bummer. Prehistory gives us giant toads, giant scorpions, but no giant carnivorous plants.
I know. Of course, there are other varieties of carnivorous plants as well. There are lobster trap plants.
Oh, these are great.
Mm-hmm.
They go by the pickle jar principle, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You reach in, you grab the pickles, and you can't get your hand back out.
Right, or indeed, as the name implies, lobster traps, various crab traps. Does anyone who's ever used these know that the creature crawls in, but then it can't get out again?
Yeah.
And that's exactly how these plants do that through special structures that end up trapping the creature.
Yeah, I think there's a certain element of this I think it's actually a type of pitcher plant, but there's an element of easier to get in and apparently easy to get out until you're inside.
Yeah.
In the cobra lily, this cool example of an American carnivorous plant that I found, it grows in, I think, Northern California and Southern Oregon. And it's this beautiful looking plant that has a pitcher and is in some way carnivorous, but it's got an opening on the bottom, and then in the top it's kind of translucent so the light can come through. Mm-hmm. So I assume to an insect it looks kind of like you can exit through the top until you get inside.
All right, up next we have sticky traps, aka flied paper traps. And examples here include sundews and butterworts. So the leaves exude a sticky substance that catches lighting insects.
Okay.
Pretty basic, but yeah. Hey, it's a winning design.
I mean, I've got the willies from glue traps because I know the stories of people who've tried to use glue traps to catch rodents in their house, and that's just a sad scene.
The tragedy of glue traps is that they sound humane on the surface of things.
Not at all.
But they're not at all, especially when you realize that reptiles that gets caught in them, they're going to suffer a long time because they've evolved to go a long time between meals. So, hey, if you do, I have had to remove a snake from a glue trap before, and if you use oil, that'll really help. I think we used olive oil and we were able to free a specimen.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, I don't know if it's amazing.
I didn't know you were such a hero, Robert.
Well, it was,
can you come get my cat out of the tree? Can you come get my snake out of a glue trap?
Well, I have found that if I encounter an animal with my son, I'm often even more humane. Like, not so much snakes, because I generally am going to be cool with snakes, but this most recent trip, we came across some black widow spiders.
Whoa.
And, actually three, like really close to a house. And, normally the instinct that I grew up with is if you find a black widow spider, you go ahead and kill it because it's a highly, it's not a good animal to have around. You don't want that thing, biting you, right?
I feel like we should learn to resist that impulse.
I think so too. If it's not hurting us, then we shouldn't crush it. So we just checked it out. We actually caught one and put it in a little glass and looked at it for a little bit and then released it further away from the house.
Yeah. But then, of course, there is one other major type of carnivorous plant, right? These suction traps.
Yes, these involve highly modified leaves in the shape of a bladder with a hinge door lined with trigger hairs. So these are the ones, if I'm picturing them correctly, these are the ones that kind of remind one of pipe organs with a little bit on the top. Yeah, like a little lid on the top of the organ.
Huh.
Pipe. Yeah.
Okay, I don't think I've ever seen that.
Well, it's more like the I'm comparing it to cartoons. I think in my mind we have like a steam engine or something, and they have the little top that flips up on the top of the exhaust pipe.
Oh yeah,
yeah, kind of similar to that.
Okay, so hey, let's hit the next fact about carnivorous plants. Among the killer plants, you've got a couple different major varieties, right? So you've got carnivores, and then you've got the proto-carnivores, proto-carnivorous plants. So what would we mean by that? A proto-carnivorous plant is a plant that has the tendency to catch and kill prey, but doesn't yet have the capacity to directly digest the meal. So, for example, there are some pitcher plants that do not produce their own digestive enzymes, but rely on bacteria to dissolve organic matter in the traps. And some botanists would class protocarnivorous plants as taxons that are part of the way there, right? They're on the evolutionary path to becoming carnivores.
Yeah. It's interesting when we consider that that many carnivore lineages, you know, they enter into the carnivore game via proto-carnivore lifestyles.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of like seeing evolution in action. And I can't help but consider the relationship between figs and fig wasps.
Huh, that's here, interesting.
Which I think is a great example of, you know, a complex relationship, really a mutualistic relationship between a plant and a particular insect species.
I've never heard this mentioned as an example of a carnivorous plant, but Robert, tell us how it goes down. What's the relationship?
All right. Well, again, it's a mutualistic relationship, but there's some nutrients absorbed too at the end of the story. But the basic scenario here is that fig trees need wasps to transport pollen from one plant to the other.
Okay.
The plant provides a fig wasp with their only source of food and shelter. What we call a fig is actually a structure called a syconium, and it's really more of an inverted flower than a fruit with all of its reproductive parts located inside.
Huh.
And after a female fig wasp flies over from her home fig plant, she has to travel to the center of the syconium to lay her eggs. And to get there, she climbs down a narrow passage called the osteole. Passage is so cramped that she scrapes off her wings and her antenna during the descent. It's just a real nightmare scenario. And then once inside, there's no getting back out and flying to another plant. It's like finding a narrow hole in a cemetery and climbing down into a grave, just ripping a bunch of skin off in the process.
Wow.
And then when she's down there, well, she better hope she's in the right place.
Uh-huh.
Because fig plants boast two kinds of figs, male capra figs and then female edible figs. If she winds up in an edible fig, she eventually dies from exhaustion or starvation. She can't lay her eggs there. The stylus is in the way, but she at least delivers the pollen, which is kind of a cruel trick, right?
Right.
We see the mutualistic aspect here.
But it also kind of breaking down, right? Like the
right.
plant
gets... The plant gets what it wants, but the wasp doesn't get what it wants.
Okay.
Now, if she enters the male capra fig, she'll find male flower parts perfectly shaped to hold the eggs she'll eventually lay. The eggs grow into larvae, which then develop into male and female wasps, which emerge.
Huh.
After hatching, the blind wingless male wasp will spend the remainder of their lives digging tunnels through the fig. The female wasps then emerge through these tunnels and fly off to find a new fig carrying pollen with them.
Wow.
Now,
is a crazy process.
Yeah, it is. It's wondrous. I had figs in my backyard this year, and I thought about it every time I went out there to check on them.
Well, wait then. Is it accurate to say that in some sense the fig tree is consuming the wasp that is stuck inside it?
Yes, because this is what happens in the death fig. When a female wasp dies inside an edible fig, an enzyme in the fig called ficin breaks down her carcass into protein. So the fig basically digests the dead insect, making it a part of the resulting ripened fruit. And the crunchy bits in the figs, though, are seeds, not anatomical parts of the wasp, in case anyone was wondering.
Now, one thing I do think about here is that a fig tree doesn't seem to me to be something that is suffering from a lack of nitrogen or some other nutrient, or is it? I mean,
That's not my understanding, that it's necessarily suffering.
But it just gets some kind of, maybe even if it could survive without these wasps, I'm not saying I know that it could, but even if it could, it just gets a little extra boost.
I guess it's like using every part of the buffalo, right? I mean, the wasp is in there. It's not going anywhere.
Right. Why not digest it?
I mean, to sort of anthropomorphize the evolutionary process here a bit. But it's an interesting example, I think, of certainly a complex relationship, a mutualistic relationship, where it's kind of like thinking of it as a corporation, right? Mm-hmm. So you have Fig Tree Corp, or, you know, and they have all these different departments, and most of the departments are related to fruit production and wasp relations, but there is definitely a wasp dissolving and digesting department. It's not the primary department.
It's not, in the basement.
Yeah, it's in the basement, but it still plays a role in the overall company structure.
Okay, okay. And it's, you always got to put the payroll in.
Yeah.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Now, I wanted to see if there was any interesting new research from this year on carnivorous plants. And I came across one paper I thought was kind of interesting. It's called Pollinator-Prey Conflicts in Carnivorous Plants, When Flower and Trap Properties Mean Life or Death, from Scientific Reports, published this year in 2016. And it was studying plants of the genus Drosera, which are the sundews, right? We talked about those, the sticky trap plants.
Mm-hmm.
And it studied how the plants solve a particular problem. If you've thought about this, if you're a carnivorous plant that wants to draw insects into a death trap, but you're also a flowering plant that wants insects to spread your pollen for reproduction, how do you make sure that you don't trap and kill the insects that you need to pollinate your flowers? I'm about to say a metaphor for this. That might be the worst metaphor I've ever tried on this show. So stop me if I'm going off the rails.
Well, they can't all be zingers.
It's kind of like if you couldn't have sex without the help of a certain species of live wild rat, but you also have rat traps all over your house.
Okay.
Like kill traps. This would seem to lower your reproductive fitness.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, what the Drosera plants do in the study is they offer different visual, spatial, and chemical signals that selectively attract non-pollinators to the traps. So that they've adapted to have selective appeals in the traps versus in the pollinating structures.
Well, it's kind of like imagining these hotels and horror movies where they cannibalize the guests.
Yeah.
Like you gotta keep your Yelp rating up enough where you get more guests.
Exactly. You've gotta have enough real guests.
Yeah. But then at the same time, you need guests to eat. So you gotta find that balance.
Yeah. So in my horrible analogy, it would be sort of like having traps that are designed to kill all the rats except your sex rat that you need for reproduction.
So yeah, let's discuss the real carnivorous plants, the plants that really do prey on vertebrates.
Okay, well, we've got to start by discussing the alleged
Okay.
Ones that prey on vertebrates. So the one I want to start with is the Puya chilensis. So this is a bromeliad plant that grows in the arid parts of the Andes in South America. It's known as Puya chilensis, and it's sort of, because it's a bromeliad, it's going to be a cousin of like the pineapple. And it kind of looks like a pineapple. It looks like a giant woody pineapple with yellow-green spikes extending out at an inclined angle from the trunk. And it has been widely reported on popular websites and a few news sources that this plant is known as the, quote, sheep-eating plant.
Huh.
Because it sometimes feeds on the carcasses of livestock caught in its spines. For example, there's a 2013 BBC News piece about how the Royal Horticultural Society in Great Britain managed to grow one of these plants in a greenhouse in Surrey, and the story was about how the plant was about to flower. I think it takes a long time to do that. But the article claims, quote, "In the Andes, it uses its sharp spines to snare and trap sheep and other animals, which slowly starve to death. The animals then decay at the base of the plant, acting as a fertilizer. The RHS feeds its specimen on liquid fertilizer," and then they quote a horticulturist saying that obviously it would be problematic to feed this plant, quote, its natural diet. So despite these reports, most of which sort of repeat the same thin, summary claims over another, over and over, I have been unable to find any evidence in the scientific literature that these plants are really known to do this, to trap and kill large animals like sheep. And honestly, looking at a bunch of pictures of them, I'm also having a hard time seeing how this would happen. Like, they look like they would be painful to fall into, but not deadly traps. Also, I've read a few accounts of people who claim to work around the Puya and don't report anything about this. So this makes it seem to me like this phenomenon of sheep becoming trapped in Puya growth, dying, and then fertilizing the base of the plant is something that maybe conceivably could happen by coincidence. Like, I guess you could accept that rotting animal flesh is generally a decent fertilizer.
Yeah.
But that probably doesn't happen often enough to qualify as a real evolutionary adaptation by the plant.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, there are plenty of animals that are already going to prey on a sheep. And then if you were having sheep that are raised in a, you know, basically an artificial population of sheep, they're going to be, there's going to be a higher susceptibility to strange and unnatural deaths, right?
Yeah, so I'm skeptical of this one. I think unless somebody can send us some really good evidence that this actually takes place, I'm going to say this one actually looks like a myth to me that has somehow made it into news reports.
I think that is a safe bet.
But then there's another one that is definitely not a myth, though we have to be a little careful in how we characterize it. So I want to talk about Nepenthes, the tropical pitcher plants.
Oh, okay.
So these are pitfall traps, right? Like we've talked about pitcher plants where they've got a, they've got a deep well that has some killer fluids in it, and they want you to fall in, get stuck, and die and dissolve. Now, it's definitely worth saying that the natural prey of these plants are invertebrates. They're going to be insects. But some of these traps can grow like more than 40 centimeters deep or hold up to 2 liters of digestive fluid. That's huge. That's like a, you know, that's like a big soda bottle. Like with some of its various species having traps this big, it's sort of natural to wonder if anything bigger than an insect ever gets digested. And I'd say the answer appears to be both no and yes. So like I said, first of all, invertebrates are clearly the main prey of these plants. They appear insectivorous by evolutionary design. But animals come into the picture as well. One sense is more mutualistic. Like there are several pitcher plants that seem to have this non-predatory symbiotic relationship with vertebrates like birds, bats, and shrews. And it works like this. You've got a pitcher and it's got sweet nectar all along the outer surface. And a bird or a forest rodent comes along, decides, I want some of that nectar. And while it's hanging out at the opening of the pitcher plant, it just happens to deposit some feces inside. Now, normally you would not expect an organism to have an adaptation that incentivizes animals to poop inside it. But guess what those feces are rich in? Nitrogen.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, exactly the nutrients that the plant would normally need to get by killing insects. So there are types of pitcher plants that also seem to provide like a roosting shelter for bats as well. And the bats do the same thing. They poop into the plant and the plant gets some sweet nitrogen out of it.
Okay.
But with some of the larger tropical pitchers, what if a small mammal were to fall all the way in?
Ah.
Would it be able to get out? And if not, would the plant eat it? I think the answer is ding, 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 you bet.
Oh, see, so, this is this nightmare scenario I encounter anytime I use a composting toilet.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, those things smell bad enough anyway.
Yeah, even when they don't, I was in a really good one last week.
Oh, I shouldn't badmouth them. I'm sorry. I've been near one that smelled really bad.
But it's still horrifying because, especially like in my case, I'm putting my son on it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, he could just fall right down there. And then I guess I'd have to go down there too and fight the fluke man, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. This is a horrifying scenario, falling into a pitcher trap. God.
Yeah.
So here's the evidence. There is a photo and video documentation online of a Nepenthes research expedition that took place first in October 2012, and they were going to Mount Victoria in the Philippines, and they were studying specimens of Nepenthes attenboroughii, named after...
Oh.
Our favorite Attenborough.
Oh, that's nice.
Endemic to the region and, but the species, not Attenboroughs. But they found one pitcher of this plant that contained a wild caught dead tree shrew, and they showed it in photos and on video. And a return expedition 2 months later showed the skeletal remains of the shrew covered in a sort of layer of fur. So essentially all the soft tissues of the tree shrew appeared to have been digested by the plant.
Hmm.
So does the pitcher plant naturally target vertebrate mammals as prey? Probably not. But if there's one on offer, yeah, don't mind if I do. That seems to be the approach. But now the real question is, could it be possible for a real world plant to be the man-eating tree, the killer tree that would trap and kill large megafauna like a deer or a bear or a human being?
Hmm. Or even something like a raccoon, right? I mean.
Oh yeah, it's settled like, for a raccoon.
Yeah.
Medium size.
Yeah, cause the bat possibility and the shrew possibility is kind of iffy, right? So anything larger than that, it becomes increasingly fantastic.
Yeah. So I will say, first of all, I found no evidence that a plant like this already exists. I'll start with the bad news. But the good news, or maybe the bad news, who knows what's good and bad anymore.
It depends where you stand on plants killing and eating humans.
Is that there are some interesting leads. So first of all, I want to consider the possibility of a proto-carnivorous bramble trap. So I watched a video blog, and this is not scientific information. This was a video blog by an Irish sheep farmer. And this guy was personally insisting that the blackberry brambles on his land are carnivorous, or he called them carnivorous. I think more accurately, you would call them proto-carnivorous,
mm-hmm.
but if he's correct. But here's his argument. He says, by demonstrating how his sheep become trapped in these brambles all the time, they get their woolly coats caught in the hook-like thorns, and then they struggle and they get more and more tangled in the branches as they struggle to escape. That's kind of interesting. I guess the idea is that they get caught, they can't escape, they die. It's kind of like what was being alleged with the Puya chilensis, that they would fall down near the base of the plant, rot, and fertilize the soil.
Well, even if they, in doing this, if they didn't kill the animal outright, even if they didn't allow starvation to occur, they could conceivably have the plant just holding it long enough for a predator to come take advantage of it, eat part of it, but still leave portions of the creature to rot.
Oh, that's interesting too. I hadn't thought about that.
Pure conjecture.
Now, I do want to say I'm not going to endorse the hypothesis of carnivorous brambles here, mm-hmm. because I think we don't have evidence that's necessarily what's going on. I think you'd have to demonstrate that this is actually an adaptation towards which bramble evolution was shaped. Like, were there similar woolly animals native to the regions wherever these plants evolved? Would one of these animals rotting at the base of the bramble plant really provide enough nutrition incentive to make a major difference in survival and reproduction? Like, would the nutrients it provides matter enough for this to be an evolved trait that is targeted by selection?
Yeah, because to come back to the fig tree scenario, think of it as a well-run corporation.
Yeah.
At what point do the CEOs or the board of directors or whatever?
We're going to invest in the processing division.
Yeah, it's like, tell me more about this sheep-eating division that you're working on this project. All right, let's hire some more people. Let's invest more in that, and let's bump it up in the overall hierarchy.
Exactly. So I haven't seen evidence that that's what's going on with the brambles yet. But given all these questions, I do want to say I could believe it's possible that some bramble-type plant could establish an evolutionary pathway toward proto-carnivory and eventually full carnivory, starting with accidental snagging of sheep and other unfortunate creatures that are covered in suicide Velcro.
You know, this reminds me of a specimen that I encountered in Arizona last week, and that's the death's claw, or Harvogaphytum, also known as a grapple plant or a wood spider.
Oh, wood spider.
Yeah.
That is gold.
They're pretty gnarly looking. They're from the sesame family, but they're a hooked fruit. So it starts when it's growing initially, it kind of looks like a weird green banana. And apparently it can be consumed. I did not eat one, but I was told that yes, some people have things they can do with these. But it starts off like a banana and then it kind of splits in the middle. And so it ends up like, if imagine your hand making the devil horns.
Mm-hmm.
And then imagine if you had super long curvy fingernails on both of the protruding fingers.
Okay? Nasty.
Yeah. And so what it does is when a mule deer or a pronghorn, a horse, or even a human comes along, it latches onto the ankle.
Mm-hmm.
The devil horns here latch around and it carries the fruit across, long distances. And it does not hurt the animal in question. And actually, they seem to have anti-inflammatory properties that are utilized in some folk medicines.
Huh.
But if this is possible, yeah, why not a grappling mammal-killing root as well?
Yeah. I guess we'd have to come back to the question of, is the incentive there?
Right.
Is the evolutionary incentive big enough to work on these powerful structures?
Yes.
Another way to ask this question, another scenario for this, how about a human-sized snap trap? Sort of like what I pictured in the grove of the killer tree at the beginning. So imagine this. It's a Venus flytrap large enough to capture and digest a deer or a bear or a human.
Like not so much necessarily like a Little Shop of Horrors Audrey 2, but just a giant Venus flytrap. A trap.
Yeah, it doesn't need to sing.
Yeah, it doesn't need to sing or leap out, but just large enough to lay a trap that could snag a larger creature.
Yeah. So there are obviously plants that move quickly. The Venus flytrap is one example of them. Mm-hmm. There's, plants usually exhibit very slow motion that's expressed through growth patterns rather than through fast moving of plant tissues. But there are plants that have fast moving tissues. You touch a fern and sometimes the leaves can close. The Venus flytrap can snap closed. I'm not sure how big and how sturdy you can scale up those fast movements in plants. Like,
yeah.
I've never seen a plant with huge, strong structures that exhibit fast movement. All the ones I know of with fast moving body parts tend to be pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime you see the same thing when you're talking about giant gorillas, right?
Yeah.
Anytime you scale up morphology, you're going to run into various engineering limits and you end up having to change the design in order to make it conceivably work. And then in some cases, is it even possible to upscale that design?
Yeah. But let's just imagine. Let's say, okay, imagine you can scale up fast moving plant body parts.
Okay.
Still a couple problems here. It doesn't take a lot of compression strength to hold in a fly or a spider, but imagine how many pounds of compression force it would take to hold in a human or a bear that's fighting to get out of a trap.
Yeah.
This would have to be a really strong, big, powerful plant. And I guess my question is, why would a plant evolve such an extravagant morphological contrivance? And does it even make sense to imagine how it gets to there? Because remember, carnivorous plants tend to practice animal predation in order to offset nutrient deficiencies in the soil, right? That's the whole reason we go back to. They're growing in inhospitable conditions. They can't get the nitrogen or some other nutrient they need. So they need to prey on animals to get those little molecules. But would an organism grown in such poor soil be able to attain human trapping size to begin with? Like, how does it get that big and that powerful if it hasn't been trapping humans the whole way? Would it have to, it would have to sort of like be scaling up as it goes, catching bigger and bigger animals as it gets bigger.
Yeah, and why would you, why would it evolve to depend on increasingly larger and increasingly, you know, more rare specimens? Why,
yeah.
There would be a tipping point where it would just be making its work harder for itself.
Yeah.
And therefore there would be less advantageous to its evolutionary ascent.
Yeah. And another thing to remember, as we've said on the show before, in evolution, we've always got to keep in mind bigger is not necessarily better. It seems better to us because we like bigger trucks, but bigger bodies are not necessarily better. Organisms will not tend to grow larger unless there's a clear survival advantage or reproduction advantage.
Right. It comes down to what the environment will bear, what's competitive.
Yeah.
I just a few seconds ago, I said evolutionary ascent, which we often use in talking about humans, but that's kind of a misnomer because evolution, in the same way that there's no such thing as evolving,
yeah,
evolution is not an upward or downward movement. It is just a movement.
Yeah.
And if you start thinking about it in terms of there being a goal other than survival, other than propagation, then you muddy the waters.
So, yeah, the human-sized snap trap, I'm going to say that that's something that maybe could be engineered. You know, I could imagine in the future if you're tinkering with plant genomes, trying to create something weird, it's possible that's sort of a physical – something that's physically attainable in plant morphology. I don't know. It might not even be that. But even assuming it is that, it doesn't seem like something that would arise in nature.
Right. It would need to be a mad scientist who decided he or she wanted a large man-eating plant, maybe an evil dictator who wanted it to live it at the bottom of a trap door.
Or to continue feeding witches to.
Yeah. Or how about this? How about a bio-toilet for spaceship gardens? So going back to the picture plant idea, encouraging animals to poop in it.
Okay, yeah.
Like biologically engineered compost toilet.
Or maybe it's engineered by a British nanny who is a druid who has had her tree killed with a chainsaw that she used to worship for years. She needs a new god, and so she studies genetics, she, you know, masters the art of CRISPR gene editing, and then she makes this thing.
Or has she just merely entered into contract with the space toilets, who overthrew another alien species because they were tired of just being pooped into?
Okay, Robert, I think we're done.
Yeah, we've gone off the deep end here. But I think we've covered some fictional ground here. We've covered some mythological, some cryptid ground, as well as the more solid soil of actual scientific inquiry. And nothing ate us in the process. So I guess we're doing okay.
It would be a good way to go, though.
It would be a noteworthy way to go.
Not a pleasant way to go, but yeah, it'd be good to be remembered.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause none of these scenarios, I think we can agree, none of the scenarios of carnivorous plants actually sounds pleasant. All of it takes place, the death ends up occurring at the slow rate that is typical of a plant's slower approach to life.
Yeah. You'd really be hoping a bear would come along and get into you.
Yeah. All right. So there you have it. Carnivorous plants. Hey, if you want to learn more about this topic, if you want to discover other topics than we've done, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to our various social media accounts. Those include Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and who knows what will evolve in the future. We'll probably sign up for those as well and give you another way to interact with us and indeed tell us about any fictional carnivorous plants that we may have missed or we should explore, as well as your thoughts on the possibility of a man-eating plant.
And of course, if you would like to continue to get tangled in the killer vines of this subject, you can email us with your thoughts about it and any feedback on this episode or others at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.